So after thinking for a while about what I might want to talk about this evening, I settled on talking about Halloween. And I thought this year maybe I wasn't going to do it, since Halloween wasn't so close to Monday as it usually has been the last couple of years. But I think it's nice every year to acknowledge the presence of Halloween. I think it's a very special kind of holiday and event and ritual in our culture. And some of the Buddhist groups in America, like the Japanese Buddhists, the Zen Buddhists, have adopted Halloween, have taken a Buddhist ceremony, and usually it happens in the summer, and they've transposed it onto Halloween because it seems better suited. And it's a ceremony celebrating, it's called Segaki. It means something like feeding the hungry ghosts. And it's feeding the unseen world, perhaps, or feeding that part of ourselves that is undernourished and desperate for nourishment. There's many ways of understanding this. And as part of the Zen centers, what they do, they have a ceremony and they feed, they first invite the hungry ghosts to come and visit, and then they feed them. And then they have this, they read a list of names of all the people who've died in the last year that have been connected to the Sangha. And once the list is finished, then anybody who is in attending the ceremony just speaks out the names of other people who've died. It's kind of like remembering people. It's kind of remembering the unseen, where people have gone. So that's one way of looking at it. But this year, my thoughts around Halloween are focused more on the demonic side of it, the demons. And it seems there's an aspect to Halloween, the aspect of the demonic and allowing the demonic to come out. But what seems odd, what seems to have happened is that the demonic has become, for the most part, tremendously domesticated at Halloween time and made completely safe. And the demons, whatever way we understand them, traditionally in the old world were terrifying. And there, you know, kind of, there was something terrifying about the encounter with them. And I was listening to on the radio yesterday, I guess. I drove up from L.A., had lots of time to listen. Oh, it was fascinating to listen to the radio going up the Central Valley and all the different kind of stations you get. Boy. Patriots for Profit. And there were this patriot group, you know, this militia group, I guess, Christian militia group that was going bankrupt and needed to raise more money. And they were called Patriots for Profit. But anyway, there was an interview with a professor named Harold Bloom. And he was talking about angels, a phenomenon, the interest, obsession with angels in America and the Western culture and all that. And he said that that most Western religions have this notion of angels. It goes back to Zoroastrian religions. But traditionally in Western religions, the angels were terrifying. They were actually quite large and big. And meeting them was quite terrifying. And somebody gave the example, I think it was it Jacob who wrestling with the angels, with the angel. And then this, he referred to a story of Muhammad, an encounter with angels, and Muhammad was really scared shitless. I mean, there wasn't these kind of nice little cherubs that come and kind of pat you on the back, and you know, like family circus. Is it family circle? Family circus? Little cartoon. The Bambi-ization of angels and demons. And there's some talk, you know, of how Halloween was co-opted by Christians in the old world. They went to Ireland or Scotland or whatever it was. And that Halloween used to be the celebration of the hungry ghosts of that part of the world. And I wonder, you know, if it was actually a case. Sometimes we're very quick to criticize Christianity for what it does. But what I was thinking about today is that, You know, Halloween means literally, the hollow part means sacred or holy. And the een part means evening. And it's referring to this, the evening before All Saints Day. And so it's All Hallow, all Saints, All Hallow, evening of All Hallow. And I never thought about it until today how that we have this day in which we're supposed to celebrate the shadow side of life, the ghosts, the demons, the devils, whatever. And then that's followed by this day in which we celebrate all the saints. And traditionally that's considered to be one of the classic dualities, the demons and the saints. And in my many years of being around America, unless you could go to Catholic churches or something, I never made that association that one follows the other. And I was just wondering today, what does that mean that one follows the other? In some cultures and in some Buddhist ceremonies, there is a calling forth sometimes of the demons, of the hungry ghosts, of the ghosts. And then at the end of that, there's a kind of closure that happens. And that closure is then returning to, not necessarily the world, the normal world, but returning to a healed world, an integrated world, where the demonic or the shadow sides or the hungry ghost side is no longer, is integrated back into our personality. And I don't know how we want to understand demons, but I believe the demonic within us in part arises from things that we hold separate from ourselves, that are unacceptable and we hold at a distance. And it's almost the creation of separation, of unacceptability. This is not something I'm willing to look at or deal with. That almost is what creates something into a demon. It gives its power and its strength. And I've said this next point, I guess, often enough. I apologize for repeating it. But in Buddhist culture puts a tremendous value on things like loving kindness, compassion, non-contentiousness, being at peace. When you have a culture that does that, it tends to create shadows, because we live together in a culture together, and we don't necessarily want to kind of live those ways, and we then kind of don't want to express very much those that are the things that are opposites of that. And perhaps in a cultural way, maybe that's okay to some degree, especially if we realize that cultural movements of certain values tend to create shadows. And the shadow in a Buddhist culture is that oftentimes expressions of anger are not appreciated very much. You kind of, people hide it or repress it. And it's often leads to certain kinds of trouble in Buddhist cultures and Buddhist centers in America, and where people don't express or their anger, don't work with it, or don't know how really, because they're trying to be very kind to each other in a genuine way. So Buddhist culture tends to create shadows. Buddhist practice tends to reveal the shadows. So it's very important, if you're in a Buddhist culture, to remember to practice. And one of the places you see this is on retreats, particularly, but any kind of practice, I think, draws that part out. Because practice, to me, is allowing the unseen world, allowing the what's held at a distance and what we don't want to look at, to allow it to surface, to allow it to show itself, to allow it to come. And if you go on longer retreats, that's often what happens, because it's very hard in the continual effort to be mindful and awake, in the continual effort to be attentive, for us to keep holding down the lids or repression that holds away the things that are unacceptable, things we don't want to look at. And when these things, when there are things like anger or fear or judgments or anxiety or pride or inner power of strength, inner powers of love, things which are somehow frightening to us, when those kind of are kept in the dark, they have a way, they often don't stay in the dark kind of quietly and peacefully and kind of go to sleep in the dark. But sometimes they're kind of still active in the dark, kind of gnawing at us and affecting us kind of from the sideways or from the background or from the underground. And when they do appear, the resistance or the aversions to them only provides them with more fuel. It almost feeds them. The demons tend to feed on the repelling energy. We repel them. There's a wonderful story that I've told of have I told it too many times? The story of the yaksha on Brahma's throne. There was Brahma is the greatest god of the Indian or the Hindu the Buddhist pantheon of gods, and he's kind of like the god of the gods, the king of the gods, the ruler of the heavens. He's a pretty hot guy. And so he has his throne, he has in the palace. And one day he left, he was out on a trip, and this ugly little runt of a raksha came and hopped up on his throne. And you're not supposed to do that, because that's, you know, tremendously disrespectful for anybody but Brahma to sit on the throne. So all the other kind of god attendants in the palace got all upset. And they started yelling at this yaksha, "You have to get off the throne! You have to get off the throne! How could you? It's terrible!" And as the more angry they got, and the more upset they got, the bigger and larger and more beautiful this yaksha became. And they became confused. So finally one of them went to find Brahma and said, "You know, we're confused and we don't know what's going on here, but there's a problem back home." And he explained the situation, and Brahma said, "Oh, I know what to do." So Brahma went back to his palace and got in front of the throne. And he got down and he bowed deeply. Started doing bows, prostrations to the yaksha. And kind of paying the respects and saying, "You know, I'm very happy to see you and I came here to pay my respects." And the more he paid his respects, the more he saw the yaksha and honored it in a sense, the smaller and smaller the yaksha got until finally it disappeared. And then the yaksha, and Brahma explained that this particular yaksha, this particular little troll, was an anger-feeding troll, a yaksha. And so the more angry it got, the more happy and bigger and better fed it got to be. So the anger-feeding yakshas of our life. One of the Christian desert fathers wrote, "It is not because evil thoughts come to us that we are condemned, but only because we make use of the evil thoughts." It's a very accepting way of seeing our life. We don't use the same language, but the problem is not so much the arisal of strange and uncomfortable and bad thoughts or bad visions or bad feelings or whatever way we want to call, you know, bad is a very strange word to use, but it's also the appearance of these aspects is not the problem. It's how we use them, how we interact with them, what we do with them. Do we feed them with our anger? The Buddhist tradition then personifies the demonic, the demons in our life, in the form of Mara. And Mara, the word Mara means death. And Mara is the god of kind of temptation or in Buddhism. And Mara traditionally has 10 armies with which to fight with. And these are things like sensual desire, lust, discontent and aversion, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and torpor, fear, doubt, obstinacy, praise and fame, slander, disparaging others. All things that can be very painful aspects of our life, aspects of our life that some people don't want to look at, that are frightening to people. Is that what makes something demonic? Is that is our fear of it? If we're no longer afraid, is it demonic? I don't know. Buddhism gives three approaches to be with the powerful, fearful, terrifying forces within us. One is it's kind of, maybe this is doesn't sound too significant, but it's considered to be very significant, and that is to associate with wise people, to associate with other people who are wise in the practice, who are mature in the practice, other practitioners, to associate with them, to be around them, not to be around other people who are, you know, maybe as afraid as you are, or feed those aspects of you. And it occurs to me, it's a story of, there's a friend of mine that I'm now dead, named Isan Dorsey, some of you know him. Wonderful Zen priest who lived in San Francisco. And before he was a Zen priest, he was totally wild. He was one of the early, 1950s, one of the early transvestite performers, traveled around the country and performed and lived, was part of the Haight-Ashbury in the early 60s, and kind of was the house mother of a commune, and totally stoned out of his mind, and down living in the gutters at times. And at one point when he was really completely down and out and desperate, he went to his bedroom and he looked up and he saw on his wall, I think it was a photograph of Ramana Maharshi. And something about that photograph changed him, his motivations, his intentions, what he was doing. It kind of pulled him out of this hole that he'd sunk into. And he cleaned up his act and he went and found Suzuki Roshi and started Zen practice, and was one of the most loving people at the San Francisco Zen Center. Couldn't read. They never learned how to read and never read anything, but he was probably the wisest person there, I felt. But his association with the wise, seeing something. In Mahayana Buddhism, they have all these bodhisattvas, these savior figures. They're supposed to kind of like savior gods. And all the bodhisattvas are usually depicted as very wealthy princes or princesses or wealthy people, and they have crowns and jewelry and just really kind of made up beautifully. And fancy clothes. They're really lay people, glory, kind of very well-to-do lay people, except for one of them. And of all the pantheon of bodhisattvas, there's only one that's a monk. And that's, in Japanese, it's Jizo, Kichigarbo bodhisattva. And it's said that the bodhisattvas take different forms in order to help beings. But Jizo is the one who goes to hell and helps people who are in hellish states. And people in hellish states need sometimes the purity, the clear purity of someone who is like a monk, in order to somehow be able to pull them out or see a difference or see another way. They need to have almost a duality. They've entered into a duality. They've sunk into a very deep duality of hellish state. And so you need to have the other half of that duality in order perhaps to be able to pull you out, to be inspired or be helped. So association with the wise. The second way is through insight, which is what insight practice is about. Through insight of how things really are, to really see and understand clearly what this phenomena is, to turn towards it in a sense to understand it. And the third is not necessarily Buddhist, but a very common thing I think, is to turn towards a source of power greater than that demon, greater than the hellish state, greater than the demonic. Theistic religions is usually turning towards the power of a god, which is greater, more powerful, and trusting and resting and letting the power of that god then take care of the difficult demon, the difficult state. And in Buddhism, there are similar things where you kind of trust, you rest, you take refuge in something that's more powerful on the side of the wholesome. And I think it's just a kind of fancy way of getting us to learn to deeply trust and accept. And I believe that the very deep trust and acceptance of ourselves in the situation is what makes the demonic safe, or makes it safe for us to be present for it. And so there's different ways of getting that. And one way is through insight, and one way is by trusting something else. On the insight part, there's two things I want to talk about today. One is the naming of it. Naming of the state that arises. A man that I saw this weekend his wife died a few months ago. And he's going through the full range of feelings and emotions that associated with that. And he was very free in allowing it. But there was some state that was very powerful and agitating for him, very difficult for him to be with, that lasted for several weeks. And then he was talking to a friend, and his friend was describing how he was feeling. And he said he was full of terror. And when his friend said the word terror, it fit his own experience. And as soon as he had a name for it, and kind of he could really recognize it for what it was, and that in that moment he said he felt kind of released from it. And there's a way in which very strong states, sometimes, if you can really identify and name it properly, sometimes you can be released from it. With the example I think I gave a few weeks ago, of I was feeling kind of lousy. I didn't know quite what it was, but I certainly felt lousy. And so I lay down on my bed to kind of stay with myself to see what was going on. And just feel, I felt it in my body. I felt the kind of pressure and on my chest. My chest was kind of pushed up and held up. It wasn't kind of, wouldn't release itself properly. Just, I was feeling kind of the sensations of it and kind of exploring, getting to know it. And then suddenly, as I was doing this, this word, you know, this expression that I was depressed occurred to me. And as soon as I, oh, depressed, the chest let go. As soon as I could identify what it was, very, very useful thing to be able to do. To name the demons. So now we're going to move into the ritual this evening. What are some of the demons that are here in this room?
Pain.
Fear.
Confusion. Doubt.
Separateness. Torpor. Delusion. Delusion.
Delusion. Is delusion terrifying?
Results are betrayal.
Grief.
Anger.
Restlessness.
Existence.
I would suggest that that's not an appropriate answer. It's something about existence is the demon. Existence itself is not the demon, if I may.
Sure. But it seems to me that it's the big question of existence itself that is such a demon. Do we go on existing? Uh-huh. Does existence vanish? Does everything go out like a light?
So the existential anxiety, angst.
Darkness.
Sorry?
Darkness and the unknown.
The unknown.
Change.
Fear.
Loneliness.
Missing.
What meaning?
Being separated. Hatred.
Pride.
Sword and torpor.
Shame.
Greed.
Self-doubt.
Is the all these things are beautiful, but are they? They're all on what in Buddhism we consider the unwholesome side of existence. Are none of you afraid of the wholesome sides?
Identification.
Is anybody afraid of love?
I don't know what you mean by afraid of love.
Terrified. Terrified.
Because love is the absence of fear. And how can you be afraid of the absence of fear?
I think that, for example, love makes us very vulnerable. Love involves risk sometimes. Love has sometimes been betrayed in the past, so it's just the idea of frightening.
Betrayed in love that feels betrayed is wanting.
Mm-hmm.
And the love that has no fear attached is
not. I think so.
And you just don't get fear. One of the ways to increase your love is to take a look at the fears you have.
That's for sure. That's right. But still, there are people who are afraid of love. It begins poking up, and they pull away. There's too much energy. There's too much power there. There's too much possibility there. There's too much risk there. There's too much. You know, it resonates too closely with betrayals and hurts from the past. So what you're saying is true. But I know it's fairly common for people also to be afraid of love. There are people who are afraid of joy. There are people who are afraid of peace. They're terrified by it. There are people who are afraid of being without fear because they've understood the world through the eyes of fear, and without that they don't know how to be.
Fear of freedom?
Fear of freedom. Power. Afraid of one's own power. You know, sorry?
Trust.
Fear of trust.
Silence.
Fear of silence.
Happiness.
Mm-hmm. So first, there all these things are invited. And having been invited, when they're kind of here in the room with us, then the next step thing to do is to feed them. How do we feed all those things? Instead of turning away from them or denying them, and just, instead of just kind of watching them, what is feeding them like?
Attention.
Okay, attention. Yeah. Sorry?
Reaction.
Explain.
If an unpleasant, if a demon comes up, you react to it by pulling back,
mm-hmm.
tightening up.
Mm-hmm. There's actually, maybe you could clarify, because I kind of maybe, is that, you know, the Yaksha story, your feeding gets bigger and bigger. You know, you feed it with your anger. But I think that if you look deeply into a demon, I don't know if this is always true, but I think often enough that the sources of the demon is a hungry ghost. And a hungry ghost is a part of ourselves which is unfulfilled, feeling inadequate, feeling very hungry, feeling like I can't get enough, feeling a great lack and great wanting, great craving for something to fill ourselves, fill some lack within us. But that craving, that wanting, nothing can fill it, because the classic example is the hungry ghosts have these huge, huge, huge stomachs and very, 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 very thin necks. And you simply can't get enough food in there to satisfy all the wanting. So it's not so much the demons which are invited for the ceremony, but it's the hungry ghosts. And if the hungry ghosts are the source of the demons, so looking at something, looking at the difficult things, looking at what we're afraid of, if we look carefully and deeply enough, sometimes we'll see that the source of it, the source of people's motivation to be evil, source of people's fear, the source of people's anxiety about many things, sometimes often comes from a kind of hungry ghost, something unfulfilled, unaccepted within us. So then the question is, so it's a different question in feeding the demon, the yaksha. The question is feeding, how to feed the hungry ghost. That's what happens in the ceremony. So that's the question. How do you feed the hungry ghost that's a source of all this?
Allow it to be.
Uh-huh. And you might think about some of the words, some of the demons that came up, and you might think, what would be a way of feeding it appropriately?
Compassion.
Yeah. Compassion? Forgiveness.
Acceptance.
Kindness.
Embracing.
Mm-hmm.
Acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feed a hungry ghost that wants love and reassurance all the time? And demonically that shows up as horrendous fears of loneliness and separation and abandonment.
Uh-huh.
But the hungry ghost underneath just wants love and they can't get enough love.
If you simply can't get enough love, then there's probably some feeling of lack or emptiness that you need to identify that feeling directly in and of itself. And then we place ourselves into that feeling of lack. We don't love necessarily the hungry ghost, that phenomena, that movement, that craving, but we find the sense of lack that it arises out of. And we place ourselves in that lack. I think if you keep loving that which demands love kind of neurotically, it never gets enough. But you have to identify the feeling of inadequacy or the unworthiness or the fear or the loneliness or the separation. To find that, sense it, feel it within us very carefully. If you don't find it, then you can't really feed it. So the hungry ghost is not necessarily the desire for lots of love. The hungry ghost is that feeling of being empty inside. So you have to find that feeling of empty, and then that's what gets fed. That's what needs to get fit. It's, I don't know how to, this sounds quite right, but that you feed that with love. You don't feed the desire for love with love. You don't feed the appetite for it, but you feed the kind of the what's deeper than that. And one way you feel you give it loving kindness, or you feed it with yourself. And this is another way of doing another way of working with hungry ghosts or the more demonic side of hungry ghosts is. You don't simply name it, but you turn yourself into it, or you surrender to it, abandon yourself to it, become it, exaggerate it. Don't hold yourself at a distance, even with the mindfulness, even with the attempt to accept it and love it and all these wonderful things. Take some time, and don't just do it. Do it in a kind of ritual space. Sit yourself down, for example, or go to some place and where it's safe, where you're not going to kill anybody. And allow that to arise within you, and in a sense become it, to really get to know it well. And when you really allow it to arise, and maybe even exaggerate it, then you can ask sometimes, what does this thing really want? But sometimes if we hold ourselves at a distance, it's really hard to see that. So the ceremony, this ritual of Halloween, which is has become kind of like carnival, is... Which carnivals have had that function down through the centuries in many cultures, where you take on, not necessarily any old fun identity, but you take on some kind of force within you which you want to give light to the air for a while. That's usually kind of in the background and maybe hidden because it's in the shadow of what's normally culturally accepted. And you find some way, a social ritual or private ritual or something, to allow that which usually doesn't get a chance to be shown itself, to really come out fully. And there's many, many ways you can do that, but to really give it that way. And that means, maybe it's not a big part of who you are, but it's part of you who's never had a chance. So you put on the costume, and whatever it takes. And sometimes if we do that, if we can become it, or give space to it, exaggerate it almost, sometimes you'd be surprised at what it kind of leads to. So if you become your anger, the anger can turn into, you really get into it, ferocity. The ferocity loses its kind of, begins losing the anger part of it, and the ferocity becomes a tremendous sense of inner power, which has gotten confused. And so the power comes out and it's kind of given birth. I don't know if that. So many of us are hungry ghosts, hungry for nourishment, longing for things, and finding ways to express it, to find it, to allow it, to nourish it, to feed it, is a very important part of Buddhist practice, to name it clearly enough and then to explore it and be it. Having done all that, then the part of that is bringing it out into the surface so it can be integrated into our personality. And I think that part of what's demonic is when there's a clear separation between what's in our personality or willing to be incorporated and what's not. The unintegrated is what tends to form the demonic. And I have this quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. If only it were all so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? So rather than destroying, how do we integrate is the question. The beginning of it is to name it. The beginning of it is to allow it to surface in an accepting way, and sometimes even getting into it, kind of enjoying it, kind of acting it, carnival-like or ritual-like, so you get to know it. And then, you're all sitting so politely now, and it's after 9 o'clock. So I apologize. I'm really trying not. It's not that I'm acting out my my demon here. And so we name it, we bring it, we invoke it, we bring it forth, and then we feed it or we act it, we be it, whatever the ritual does. And then, when it's somewhat integrated or acknowledged, either we celebrate the integration or we send it back. Sometimes that's appropriate. And so anyway, at the end of the ceremony then, in Buddhism, is to chant what's called in Pali a parita, a protection chant. And the Buddha wasn't really into so much this kind of protection chants, but he allowed a few of them. And there's two classic ones. One is the Sutta on Loving Kindness, Metta Sutta, and the other is the Great Discourse on Blessings. And which one would you like me to read to end the evening?
Sure.
Blessings? Because you all know the Metta Sutta, I guess. Many of you do. So the blessings you don't know. So it starts off by a deity goes to see the Buddha, and the deity says, many deities and humans have pondered on blessings. Tell me the blessings supreme. The Buddha replied, to associate not with the foolish, to be with the wise, to honor the worthy ones, this is a blessing supreme. To reside in a suitable location, to have good past deeds done, to set oneself in the right direction, this is a blessing supreme. To be well-spoken, highly trained, well-educated, skilled in handicraft, and highly disciplined is a blessing supreme. To be well-caring of mother, of father, to look after spouse and children, to engage in a harmless occupation, this is a blessing supreme. Outstanding behavior, blameless action, open hands to all relatives, and selfless giving, this is a blessing supreme. To cease and abstain from evil, to avoid intoxicants, to be diligent in virtuous practices, this is a blessing supreme. To be reverent and humble, content and grateful, to hear the Dharma at the right time, meaning it before 9 o'clock. This is a blessing supreme. To be patient and obedient, to visit with spiritual people, to discuss the Dharma at the right time, this is a blessing supreme. Okay. To live austerely and purely, to see the noble truths, and to realize nirvana, this is the blessing supreme. A mind unshaken when touched by worldly states, sorrowless, stainless, and secure, this is the blessing supreme. Those who have fulfilled all these are everywhere invincible. They find well-being everywhere. Theirs is the blessing supreme. So may you all be blessed. And enjoy your Halloween. And then if you enjoy your Halloween a lot, then remember what the next day is. And celebrate that day too. All Saints Day.
Yesterday about a week-long retreat or something that takes place between Christmas and New Year's.
Yes, yes.
Is that happening?
Oh, yes.
Is that open to people?
It's open, yeah.
I can go?
You can go if there's still space, which it probably is, but you should call soon.
How do I find out about it?
If you look in the Spirit Rock newsletter, which are up on the table, or even
in
our little newsletter, it might be in there. There's a phone number of the retreat center, and they're taking the registration.
And which retreat center is it?
It's
not Spirit Rock.
No, it's in Santa Cruz. It's called the Land of the Medicine Buddha.
Land of what?
Medicine Buddha.
Okay. And where is it going to be held?
It's in Aptos.
Oh, it's close.
Yeah, it's close. And it's a little bit rustic, and there's a dorm, two or three people to a room.
Is it very expensive?
I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe around $300.
How much?
Around $300.
Not too bad.
And have you been on a retreat before?
No.
You're welcome to come. You should realize what it is. It's a silent retreat.
The whole time.
There's Dharma talks and interviews, but it's silent. And there's a schedule of sitting and walking, which goes on. Practicing goes throughout the day, and there's not much else going on.
Yeah.
The only entertainment is the meals and the Dharma talk.
Well, I feel like I'm ready for
great.
That kind of thing. I have done one day. So I've gone up to the Spirit Rock.
If you've done one day, you know, and it's a little bit different than most one days at Spirit Rock, because there's much more talking in one day at Spirit Rock, isn't there?
Yeah, it was a lot of talking.
There's really silent.
Yeah. But
you're probably ready if you've done a series of one days. Please come.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like I am. I'm ready.
So if you have trouble finding the phone number, let me know. And
okay. Thank you.
Hi.
You know, I was interested because when we were sitting, I had this kind of like I met with kind of a dead friend died three months ago. Because he took me into this weird space. He has painted these pictures with these dark figures, like flames coming out of the heads, and I never really liked these pictures.
In life or in your image now?
In life. And I have some of them. I have pictures of photos of them. And it's a weird kind of dark space, but a weird space. And this guy is so... He always was so... He had something so peaceful.
Maybe that's why. Because he painted it.
Yeah.
So it can be... You think that's why? In life he was peaceful?
Very. I mean, he was the nicest guy I've ever seen.
It's easier to be peaceful and nice if you have are very honest about the demons.
Yeah.
And if he's painting it, he's being honest.
He definitely had a way of dealing with those dark powers without them ruling him, you know. This apartment, he had covered all his windows, and he had these skulls hanging around. And you know, you had the sense that this was going way up, although it was really, when they cleaned it out, it was a normal apartment, but you had the sense of being in a uterus or in a cave or something.
Interesting. How did he die?
No, he died very strange. He died lying on his back, like initially lying down. And his friends were really... He died the very day when I moved away from Albuquerque. I mean, it was really very, very strange.
He just died in his sleep?
He must have gotten up, he lied down on the floor in the kitchen. And nobody really exactly knows what he died of. But he was lying, you know, his feet crossed, like this. Very strange. But it was him. He probably thought he was lying down. And he probably thought, well, I guess I'm dying. He was kind of a guy like that.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, this vision of him leading me into this dark world. It's like, you can't even make me scared of that dark world, you know, because he's so good. I mean,
nice.
Good is just like overruling.
Mm-hmm. Nice, he's a guide.
And it's kind of strange because it's always such a strange experience to be connected with him, because I always think that death is like separate forever, you know.
Yeah,
strange. Thanks so much to your talk.
I'm glad you're crying.
I'm going to show you this picture.
Okay, please. Yes, please, bring them. Hey.
Yeah.
Like a card trick?
Same trick you had up here. Thank goodness.
Yes. What does that mean?
We decided to go for it.
A trick? Or a treat? So, is it means...
Not get married.
Oh, but go for what then?
Go for
the
world together.
Go together.
So I don't want to get married.
I don't think
Go.